And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Dr. Brooks Agnew, our guest. His website, by the way, arcofmillionsofyears.com, linked up with his name on coasttocoastam.com. Let's put Noah and the other planet aside for just a moment, Brooks, if we can, and talk about black holes. Stephen Hawking last year decided to change his views on black holes, where originally he thought if anything entered it, it would be ripped to shreds. He's not saying that anymore.
Well, I think it's kind of a simultaneous realization many physicists came to. When you think about a black hole, it's difficult to picture. So I use a balloon. We call it the balloon universe, actually.
All right.
If you take a balloon in your hand, say about the size of a basketball, and about half deflated, and you put your thumbs right and left on either side of the balloon, and you press into the center of the balloon until your thumbs touch. Now what you have is...
And hopefully you don't blow up the balloon.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't blow up the universe. What you see is the effect of the gravitational distortion of space-time in a model
right
there before your
hand. And that's a good picture.
So now instead of having to travel completely around the balloon or across the open space of the inside of the balloon, all you have to do is pass between the two membranes of rubber, which are squeezed between your thumbs in the center of that balloon.
And you're there.
Right.
Okay. By doing so, do you believe that there are countless numbers of these black holes, wormholes, whatever they may be, throughout the universe?
Physicists, when they do the mathematics, and I'll kind of touch a little bit on superstring theory here, we generate what we call quantum foam. Now, there are four forces in the universe: electromagnetism, the strong and weak molecular forces, and then there's gravity. Now, all the math that we've been able to do in physics up to this point does a very good job at describing the first three. But when you throw gravity into Einstein's equations or into Riemann's equations, things don't make sense. Gravity is such a weak force that you end up with answers like infinity, which we don't like to reach. So when you think about universes or dimensions, they become innumerable. They become countless. And this quantum foam connections, as it were, between one point in the universe,
mm-hmm,
or one universe and another universe.
And another one.
It becomes innumerable and almost unimaginable, unmanageable for the human mind.
These black holes, Brooks, were they created for transportation purposes? I mean, were they there so we could step from one area to another? What do you think its purpose was?
I think the purpose is that, exactly. The distances across what we can see as space, what we think is linear space, because light, we believe, travels in a straight line and hits the lens of the Hubble telescope, and we say, oh, that's so far away.
Exactly.
Possibly because of gravity and motion and the effects of all this, light doesn't travel in a straight line at all. It curves. It goes around like a continuous ball. And the distances are so daunting when you think of something like, well, let's say UFOs, and we think, gee, they must come from another planet. Well, even if they traveled at the speed of light, it would be hundreds of millions of years before any craft could travel from one side of our galaxy to our side of the galaxy to visit our little blue planet. By that time, their home world's gone, and we're so far advanced or so extinct that by the time they get here, it wouldn't be worth the trip.
Good point.
There must be some other way to slip from one point in the universe to another, or from one universe to another. And in the book, we sort of touch on what's called transdimensional travel. And I know that's been covered by a lot of your guests. I've been entertained by it over the years,
uh-huh,
too. And I don't really have the math to explain it, but there, when you eliminate all the impossible, what is left is the answer.
How would you, if we were to travel this way, this is the one thing that always puzzled me, how do you know what black hole or wormhole you're going into and where you're going to come out of. Can you control that?
Sounds like it would take a lot of exploration and recording of what happened in order to have some kind of manual how to stay to one side or the other.
Right, exact. Don't go through that wormhole. You're going to end up 10 zillion years away or something.
Yeah, and there are paradoxes and perturbances that we struggle with for years. We send vacuum fluctuations through a bridge, Einstein-Rosen bridge, formed from one point in the universe to the other, and the theory is that those are supported by neutron star material from the inside, but when we start to do the math, we find out that when we return before we left, and so the feedback, I guess it, you can call it, from that action actually destroys the wormhole before it's even formed. So what breakthrough we do in the book is we demonstrate that wormholes may actually be supported from the outside and not the inside by going through the center of these black holes. In that case, a wormhole can stay stable for hundreds of millions of years and be navigable by explorers who become skilled at doing this.
You do believe in extraterrestrial life out there?
I don't see how anybody can logically say that we are the only life form in the universe. And if you think about it and listen to the DNA map that we're uncovering, we may very well be the ET.
I've always believed that. It's kind of refreshing to hear you say that. I've believed that we've been seeded, maybe genetically altered, who knows what, but that we definitely came from above. And I also think what's important and refreshing about what you're saying, Brooks, is you believe in a creator.
Yes, we believe in intelligent design from a creator, and we try not to get involved in the religion of that.
I understand.
We sort of talk about all sides. The very first chapter in the book is called The Beginning, and it covers a little over two dozen major ancient texts around which each one there's a religion built. And we try not to get involved in the religion, but we do acknowledge the ability for man to reach out beyond what he can sense with his five senses and receive this pure knowledge and write it down. Be he a prophet or a seer or a revelator or a remote viewer or whatever you want to call him, whatever divinity you assign to that person, his ability cannot be denied, his or her ability, and the history that they recorded, although it attempts to literally burn it out of existence, melt it out of existence, genocidically remove all those that believe it, it survives. And we now have it in the latter days, and we can put these things together and make sense out of it.
You know, because it seems to me that with these black holes, and they are real indeed, they're out there, that there was even a design for them. And, you know, when you begin to think about all this, I mean, it's truly magnificent. It really is. And to think of the architect who would think about all this and I would assume not make a mistake, it's pretty dramatic.
Yes, in the introduction of the book, I make mention of that. I have a personal philosophy that everything we do will eventually affect the universe. I try to do that on purpose as often as I can. But one of the things that I've done is keep my family awake over the last 40 years, thinking about the tailor's workmanship about this universe. Mm-hmm. The more that I learn about it, the more mathematics that I master, the greater the order and intelligence, not the chaos and degradation and unmanageable patterns of confusion, but I see order, and I see purpose, and I see design.